Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's July 8th, 2006, and I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today. I'm very pleased to have with us today Jeffrey Steinberg, who's one of the editors of the Executive Intelligence Review and a longtime leading collaborator of Lyndon LaRouche. What we'll be discussing today is the epic battle underway with LaRouche and his allies engaged in a campaign to remove the fascist Felix Rohatyn from any position of influence over the Democratic Party. This is a showdown between LaRouche, who represents the historic tradition of Franklin Roosevelt in the Democratic Party, and Rohatyn, who represents the living legacy of the international synarchist forces who placed Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini in power in the 20s and 30s. Jeff has just returned from Berlin, where he participated in an international conference with Mr. LaRouche, which took up the necessity of winning this battle against Rohatyn now. As LaRouche has written in a June 22, 2006 piece, which is part of the new LaRouche PAC white paper, in fact, it's the lead of that, time is running out for the United States. So, Jeff, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thanks, Harley. It's great to be here with you.
Okay, and we also have as guests with us for our LaRouche Youth Movement panel, two members of the LIM, Delonte Bess from Boston. Hello, Delonte, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, Harley?
And Nicole James, who's today in the nation's capital.
Hey.
And they'll be joining us a little while later in the program. But, Jeff, let's begin with the leading issue. What does Lyndon LaRouche mean when he says time is running out for the USA?
Well, first of all, Lynn, in Berlin and in all of his recent writings, has always lunged with the fact that we are on the verge of the biggest financial meltdown in modern history, significantly beyond even the events of 1929, which brought on the Great Depression and European financiers installed Nazi and fascist governments in power all over Europe. The crisis today is much deeper, and so everything begins from the standpoint that either we're going to have the kind of global financial reorganization that LaRouche has proposed based on a convening of a new Bretton Woods conference among sovereign governments, or we are going to see a replay of what happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s on a global scale.
Jeff, let me just ask you on that, because you were just in Berlin and there were a number of economists and representatives of governments there from Europe, including Germany and Russia, who heard Lynn's speech. And you also do a lot of work in Washington, D.C., in the Senate and the House. Is there a difference in understanding the nature of this meltdown, this global financial disintegration that's underway between people in Europe and in the United States?
Among people within the financial community itself, I would say that both in Europe and in the United States, there is a recognition that the system is doomed. For example, I was at a meeting yesterday in a U.S. Senate office, and about a week ago, a group of senators associated with the Manufacturing Caucus had had a meeting with Warren Buffett, obviously not one of our favorite people, one of the leading financiers allied with Felix Rohatyn, big financial booster of your friend from California there, Harley, Governor Schwarzenegger, close ally of George Shultz. But in the course of the discussion, a number of the senators were sort of wisecracking about the financial situation and various scare statements that have been coming out, and they asked Buffett for his appraisal. And Buffett said, the system is doomed. It's finished. I don't give it five more years. Now, we can, you know, quibble with him over 5 years versus 5 weeks or 5 months. Mm-hmm. But even someone like Buffett is saying the system is doomed. Former Treasury Secretary Rubin has called repeatedly into members of the House and the Senate. We've heard it from members of Congress and their senior staff people telling them the system is doomed and that you know, therefore, the great danger is that you've got an executive branch run by nincompoops and fascists who are not prepared to do what Roosevelt did in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, at this Berlin conference, it was very striking to me that a number of very important people from the German financial community, including Professor Hankel, one of the deans of the German economics school and, you know, of the post-war economic recovery. He was the chief economist at the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau, which was modeled on FDR's Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
He chose to speak publicly with Mr. LaRouche on the keynote panel and talked very much in technical monetary terms, but drew the identical conclusions that Mr. LaRouche did. The system is doomed. We had a young economist from one of the leading Frankfurt banks who made a PowerPoint presentation. Same conclusion. The system is doomed. So the issue is not a dispute among people in the know.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people in politics in the United States of our boomer generation who are in a state of hysterical denial about the reality, but that can't change the reality.
Mm-hmm.
So what you said at the outset, that we are in a fight between the forces grouping around LaRouche on the one side and the forces personified by Felix Rowetten on the other. Rowetten represents what happened in Europe in the 1930s, quite literally. Fascism, Nazism, war, genocide, that's their solution.
Let me just make a point here because I want you to continue on that, but we're going to be producing a white paper with the proceedings from the Berlin conference, which includes your speech, a very important speech by Professor Cliff Karakoff, the opening remarks from Lyndon LaRouche, Helga Zepp LaRouche's speech, a piece from Jacques Cheminade on the fascist policies in France right now, and then some concluding remarks from Lynn. So can you just summarize what it is that was presented that demonstrates conclusively that Rowetten's not just a guy with a bad plan or another bad New York banker, but does represent the same current that led to Hitler coming to power in Germany in 1933?
Well, let me just tell you that after having heard Lynn's keynote speech and then Cliff Karakoff's presentation on the attempts by the Morgan, DuPont, Mellon group here in the United States to carry out a fascist coup against Franklin Roosevelt, I decided to juggle around a little bit the material that I presented. And I started out by reviewing three major U.S. government intelligence reports from the period of World War II. I started out, in fact, with a report that I've actually got in front of me right here, which was a U.S. military intelligence document that was written by the U.S. military attaché in Algiers, dated July 27, 1944. And the file subject was Synarchism. This is the overarching organization, conspiracy of transatlantic financiers, primarily Anglo-Dutch, French financiers with a faction on Wall Street allied with them, who put up the money to put Mussolini and then Hitler in power in Europe because it was their intention to destroy the nation-state system and create an alternative kind of global feudalism in which a small handful of private bankers and industrialists literally owned all of the strategic raw material wealth of the planet, owned all of the manufacturing capacity, and owned all of the financial institutions that had a vice grip control over credit.
Now, just so our listeners can be clear on this, this network in the name of Synarchy was identified by U.S. intelligence during World War II.
Right. These are documents that I presented in Berlin. And as I say, one of the first things that I reported from was this Algiers document by the U.S. military attaché from July of 1944. And he reported on the fact that the De Gaulle Free French Movement in Algiers was being targeted for penetration by the synarchists. And the military attaché, who had good contacts with some of the intelligence people in the De Gaulle movement, reported that De Gaulle himself had ordered an investigation into determining who were the synarchists who had infiltrated the Free French. Now, an earlier U.S. intelligence report from the Coordinator of Information from the fall of 1941, which was called Synarchy and the Policy of the Banque Worms Group, reported on the fact that the entire government of Vichy France, this was the Nazi puppet regime in the south of France when northern France, Paris, were directly occupied by the Nazis, was dominated by the synarchists and particularly by officials of Banque Worms, which was a closely allied, virtually creation of the Lazard Bank, which is where Felix Rowatton comes into our story. But in this 1944 document, the U.S. military attaché appended a list of the known leading synarchists operating in France, both in France with the Nazis and as infiltrators into the anti-Nazi Free French movement. And about a third of the way down a list of about 80 names of individuals and organizations, we find Banque Lazard and the name André Maillard. Now, André Maillard was the managing director of the Lazard Bank, was enthusiastically supportive of a French collaboration with the Nazis, and would later be the mentor, literally hand-pick Felix Rohatyn, and train him as a synarchist banker and install Rohatyn in his job as managing partner of Lazard in New York. André Maillard was the banker who in the 1930s, on behalf of Royal Dutch Shell, helped to create Banque Worms for what was previously an industrial and shipping group headed up by a guy named Hippolyte Worms, who was one of the leading synarchists in France. At this time, Sir Henry Dieterding, who was the chairman of Royal Dutch Shell, was known to be one of the major financiers of Hitler and the Nazi Party outside of Germany itself. So you had an Anglo-Dutch-French financial apparatus, an international synarchist banking apparatus, which André Maillard and later Felix Rohatyn would be instrumental players in, that were openly supporting Hitler and openly supporting the creation of an international Nazi world government that, had it succeeded, would have turned on the United States as the primary enemy and would have sought to destroy the United States of Franklin Roosevelt if they had been able to do that.
So you
That's
have
what Rohatyn is.
So you have actually demonstrated, along with Professor Kirikoff and others, that absolutely hardcore historic continuity between the supporters among the Anglo-Dutch French in the 30s and their attacks on FDR and their moves in the United States today against Lyndon LaRouche and Lynn's proposal for a bankruptcy reorganization of the U.S. economy.
Exactly. And what really sparked our attention was a series of events that began at the end of February in 2005. At that time, the Swiss bankers' newspaper, the NZZ, published a lengthy article reviewing the fact that General Motors was facing over $60 billion in debt rollover on refinancing of bonds that were coming due during the year 2005, and that because General Motors was performing so poorly, there would be very high risk premiums on these bonds. LaRouche looked at that and he said, General Motors is on the way to going bankrupt. And this is true of Ford, of Chrysler, of the entire core of the American civilian industrial base, and its machine tool capability was about to be taken down. And he wrote a series of memos to the U.S. Senate demanding immediate action, because what we found very quickly was that only about 35% of General Motors' capacity was producing all the cars they could really sell, given their loss of market share. LaRouche said Congress has to step in, has to buy up the plants that are no longer being utilized before they're mothballed and shut down or shipped overseas. And they have to be put under a federal corporate receivership. Workers have to be hired back, and the plants have to be retooled for vital infrastructure projects, high-speed rail, nuclear power plants, locks and dams, building new hospitals. And we talked to people in those plants. We talked to the UAW presidents, and they said, we know how to retool. We've done it every few years since the plants existed. We're ready to do this. And LaRouche said the federal government, and only the federal government, particularly the Congress, can save the auto sector from extermination. And at that point, we began following closely the events. In October of last year, Delphi, formerly the parts division of General Motors, filed for bankruptcy. And when we reviewed thousands of pages of bankruptcy court papers that are available in the public record, we found that the whole takedown of General Motors and the bankruptcy of Delphi was being personally orchestrated by Felix Rohatyn. And now, in the past few days, we see the clear, synarchist line of strategy behind what Rohatyn and Rothschild and others have been up to in the Delphi bankruptcy. Now what's being announced is that General Motors will enter into talks with Renault and Nissan, the French and Japanese car manufacturers that were merged a few years ago, and that now is looking to further merge with General Motors.
So you'd create a global auto cartel.
Right, a stateless auto cartel. And this is exactly what was done in the 1930s when American, British, French, and German companies wiped out the competition, asset stripped the competition, and created gigantic industrial cartels, combines of companies that had interlocking directorates. There's a very important report that was published on this by a man named James Stewart Martin, published as a book in 1950 called All Honorable Men. And Martin was the head of the decartelization program of the U.S. Army at the end of World War II. And much to his dismay, when he got into the records of the top Nazi companies, companies like IG Farben that were responsible for the gas chambers, he found to his horror that ownership of IG Farben had been passed over to the American part of the cartel, a company called American IG, and that it was impossible to dismantle the German cartels because they were ostensibly owned by Americans throughout the period of the war. And over again, he found that this international stateless apparatus of financier oligarchs, who were the same people who bankrolled Hitler, were the combined owners of the industrial and raw material wealth of the planet. By the way, one of the people deeply involved in that process was a man named Prescott Bush, who was a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman. Mm-hmm. Prescott Bush is the grandfather of the President of the United States today, the father of our former President George Herbert Walker Bush.
Jeff, you know, this is, if you just listening to you now, even though I know this, it just is so shocking that a scandal of this proportion is going on. And outside of the voice of Lyndon LaRouche, there's a general silence on this. Now, I want to come back to that in a second, but I want to give our email address out so listeners can send in their questions for Jeff. And we'll also bring in the LIM panel in just a moment. But you can email your questions to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio at laroucheppub.com. Also, I'm going to give out this number a few times during the show, but you can order copies of the white paper on the time is running out for the United States, which the actual headline is Who's Destroying American Industry? We'll also have a white paper with the report from the Berlin conference that Jeff mentioned, as well as a transcript from LaRouche's June 9th webcast, all of which will be available. Call us at 888-347-3258. That's a toll-free call for you. But if you call, you better be prepared to organize to get this story out. So it's 888-347-3258. Now, Jeff, you were talking about how Mr. LaRouche put out this initial call in late February 2005, a series of memos on saving the machine tool sector. There was some initial interest and then silence. To what is that silence attributed to? Why is this hushed up in the United States?
Well, go back to January, February of 2005, when much to the shock of the Bush-Cheney-Rove White House, the Democratic Party came out swinging and challenged the legitimacy of Bush's victory in Ohio, and then launched a very successful campaign to defeat the Bush White House attempt to privatize and loot Social Security, to basically kill one of the last remaining legacies of the FDR presidency.
And, of course, we played a very leading role in that with the pamphlets we put out and the intelligence we were putting into their hands.
Exactly. The Democratic Party tilted in the direction of LaRouche's leadership, and it was sort of, I think, best captured when a group of leading House and Senate Democrats, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, David Durbin, all went to the FDR Memorial and announced their absolute resolute commitment to defeat Social Security privatization. And at that rally, Durbin said, "I am proud to call myself an FDR Democrat." That was where we were headed. Then on this auto issue, the Democratic Party blew it. Aside from a few statements by Senator Hillary Clinton and a few other people, the Senate completely failed to act. And as we began probing and talking to contacts on the Hill, what we found out is that Felix Rohatyn personally was intervening to make sure that the Democratic Party did nothing to save the auto sector, and that at all costs, LaRouche's initiative was stymied at every turn. Why? Because Rohatyn was the architect of the destruction and cartelization and outsourcing of the entire U.S. auto sector. The Synergist objective is to destroy the United States. They hate the fact that we have a constitutional system based on the promotion of the general welfare and with a system of checks and balances in government. Felix Rohatyn and his partner in crime, George Shultz, have been working both sides of the aisle since the Bush administration came in office to destroy Democratic Party opposition and to ram through literally exactly the kind of fascist banker's coup in the White House that was being plotted against Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s by groups like the Liberty League.
Only this time we don't have a Franklin Roosevelt in the White House.
No, we have a Lyndon LaRouche out of the White House with growing influence inside the Democratic Party. And thank God that we've got that, because you're right. We have the grandson of one of Hitler's financiers sitting in the presidency, and the prospect of the United States having gone fascist in the 1930s was a very, very real phenomenon. I received by email today an article that appeared yesterday in the Chicago Sun-Times by Andrew Greeley, reviewing a new book on Roosevelt's first 100 days. And the first thing he says is that before Roosevelt's inauguration, a large faction within the banking community in the United States, within the publishing industry, wanted a fascist military dictatorship because they saw that as the only way to deal with the Depression.
Well, and that's, in fact, part of what was presented by Professor Kirikoff, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me bring in Nicole James, who's in Washington, D.C. Nicole, you're, I guess, involved in some of the hand-to-hand combat now in congressional offices to get across this point that
yeah.
the Democrats have to break with Roatan. Why don't you give us a quick report on what we're doing there?
Well, the funny thing is a lot of the questions that are coming up in Congress is around the question of, well, why can't we just go with the legislation? You know, because we go in there, we give them a briefing about international fascism, how fascism arose in Roosevelt's, during Roosevelt's time. And, you know, it's not polite to discuss that in the congressional office. So, you know, they usually want to get immediately to, well, what's the legislation about? But the point that we've been making is you can't have LaRouche's auto legislation unless we get rid of fascism. If Roatan is in office, if Roatan's continuing to fund the Democratic parties, if he's continuing to take down the infrastructure of the United States, well, then how are you going to ever even have a chance to build any of these projects if the infrastructure doesn't exist anymore? And so a certain amount of offices admitted that that is the case, that, yeah, we should figure this out. And a lot of them are afraid to talk about Roatan, even though they know who he is. But they're afraid to directly associate their offices with them. And that, you know, that gives us some insight into who's controlling a lot of the networks in the Democratic Party, and how now they're embarrassed because of what we've done in making Roatan's name a household name, how they're now embarrassed to associate themselves directly with them.
So you see this occurring then, that people in these offices are beginning to get this idea that there is a guy named Roatan and he's actually got an influence on policy?
Yeah, and even some of them who I truthfully don't know who he is, they're beginning to understand that they need to know who he is, seeing as this is the reason why certain congressmen are making the decisions, specifically on this recent recent Senate vote around the proposal of, you know, pulling the troops out of Iraq that Kerry put forward, and now only 13 senators supported this. You know, they're beginning to realize, okay, yeah, there's some control, and if you guys are saying it's Roatan, then we're going to look into this guy. And this is coming from, you know, top aides of congressional offices.
So some of the aides say they like the idea of the auto legislation, but they don't see why why no one's picking it up. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, we're carrying on an educational campaign, teaching them what the 30s were about, I guess.
Yeah. One of the confusions that we're coming up with one of the offices is why, you know, how are we going to use GM and Ford and these industrial companies to build government projects. And so we're literally having to school them on Franklin Roosevelt's administration and how he used the farming industry, the auto industry, to actually rebuild the country during the Great Depression, which you would think that people in these offices would know about, which don't.
Well, we're going to take a break in a moment. When we come back, we can talk about this question of how they've destroyed an understanding of history so that people don't know these things. So you're listening to The LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. It's also available in an archive on the LaRouchePub.com. And you can just find it where it says The LaRouche Show on the left-hand side, and we have an archive of all the previous shows, including those with Lyndon LaRouche. Now, I should note that Lyndon LaRouche is going to be giving a webcast. It's another in the series of webcasts he's been giving that have really shaped the political fight in this country over the last 5 years. So Thursday, July 20th, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche will be addressing the nation and the world once again. I'm sure the topics we're discussing today will be front and center. Those of you who want to order literature, order copies of the pamphlets we've mentioned, the white papers on the Roatan's fascism, and also the one on the Berlin Conference, the proceedings of the Berlin Conference, and also LaRouche's June 9th webcast. So those are three separate pamphlets. They can be ordered by calling us at 888-347-3258. And, of course, when you call that number, you can also order a subscription to the Executive Intelligence Review which continues to be the best source of political, economic, historical, and philosophical intelligence in the world. So we're back with Jeffrey Steinberg, with Nicole James, and I want to bring in Delonte Bess right now from Boston. Delonte, you told me before we came on the air that you're pounding the streets in Boston in preparation for a big expanded LaRouche Youth Movement recruitment drive. How's that going, and what kind of responses are you getting in Boston to the fight against fascism?
Well, that's right. Number one is the question of the takedown of even Rouhani, or even changing the political process right now, is the idea of recruitment and how many people we can particularly put on the ground every day and change, you know, creatively to sort of express some of these ideas that LaRouche has put forth. So we've drafted up a type of a curriculum for the people here in Boston, and I'm sure and other locals are doing the same thing, to become more competent in the fact that we're going to have to challenge some of the academics on these campuses and create a kind of intellectual debate within the campus work and also as we do in some of the institutional work. And one thing we've noticed, sort of organizing day to day, is look, the population is completely upset with the leadership. So we've been doing the kind of integration of bringing the constituency right into the political process. For example, we've taken the time period where we've made calls with the constituents in certain districts of the congressmen, put them directly on the line, the constituents, and got them to call the congressmen directly. And the kind of effect was, one, is that you're recruiting that individual directly to the youth movement around these intellectual ideas, and two, they're directly involved in intervening in politics right then and there. So it's been a pretty awesome process in which we've been able to integrate how the work is going here and bringing the lower 80 percentile income brackets right into the politics right now. So.
And Delonte, are you planning on bringing a crew down with you for a week of action leading into the webcast on July 20th?
Well, yeah, that's that. I mean, for the capabilities that we've done throughout the weeks of action is bringing more and more young people. I mean, just seeing the kind of dynamic changes that happen politically is by how we've been able to shape the many minds in the institutions by seeing how many more people are growing within our youth movement here. So, I mean, the main thing is that how, in fact, we are creating the process here in our own locals, in our own movement, where we're going to recruit the young people into a real intellectual debate where they really have a sense where, you know, they're going and they're seeing this financial collapse that Jeff just laid out. They're seeing fascism rise. And the act of looking at a future is really in jeopardy. So we're bringing them right into this kind of process where they can see that there's a future to change this country with these kind of ideas. So we're going to bring a busload of young people, hopefully, down to Washington on the 15th through the 20th.
Good. Hey, Jeff, since you do a lot of meetings with people in the Congress and also from the generalized institution of the presidency, how aware are they of the growing impact of the LaRouche youth movement?
Oh, they're very, very aware of it. And you've got a diverse range of reactions to it. The smart Democrats see this as the future, and they recognize that LaRouche has developed an approach to both recruiting and educating youth that nobody else in the party has figured out, not even close. So the best people are enthusiastic about the prospect that the Democratic Party has a future, and it's represented by the leading intellectuals among the LaRouche youth movement. There are other people who don't like the idea of being put under pressure to do the right thing. And, you know, the youth movement represents the most powerful and effective, persistent day-in and day-out lobbying presence, policy presence, on Capitol Hill. you know, people talk about, quote, the legendary, you know, Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and groups like that. Well, you know, I'm in D.C. They come in twice a year. Beyond that, they've got a handful of people in Washington. We get more literature into the hands of members of Congress. We have more direct face-to-face contact with them than any other institution in the United States. Everybody else relies on big money. Everybody else is a wannabe Jack Abramoff. We approach it from the standpoint of tough policy dialogue. We have no tolerance, the limb especially, no tolerance for sophistry. I wanted to just, by the way, throw in a comment relative to what you said earlier about this whole desire by people to want to deny that what we're seeing right now is a return, a vicious return of fascism.
Right.
This is a comment that Mr. LaRouche made a few weeks back that was really food for thought. He, of course, was a young man who was in the Army during World War II. He was in the China-Burma-India Theater, and he came back to the United States in 1946. And he said between 1946 and the 1948 presidential election, when Truman was elected, he had become president with Roosevelt's death in April 1945. So 1948 was his first actual election. And what LaRouche said is at that point, the FDR legacy was really stepped on. And instead, Truman fell in lockstep behind Churchill around the idea of the Cold War against Soviet communism.
Mm-hmm.
And as the result of the Cold War, as the result of the abandonment of virtually everything that Roosevelt stood for under Truman, all of a sudden, the greatest assets in the war on communism were the wartime Nazis, especially those who had been on the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, for example, in France in 1948, when de Gaulle was driven from power, the jail doors were opened up, and the Banque Verme's crowd walked out of jail. They had been sentenced to many, many years of hard labor for Nazi collaboration, for treason. And suddenly in 1948, they're all freed, and they're all back on the payroll of Banque Verme's, and many of them go to work for the British and the Dutch and the Americans.
Remember Hjalmar Schacht, who was Hitler's finance minister and who was the partner with the Harriman, Bush, Prescott Bush, Montague Norman network to put Hitler in power. Schacht was acquitted at Nuremberg, the
right.
only one of the leading Nazis acquitted. And 2-3 years later, he was picked up by Standard Oil Company to run their operations in Indonesia.
Exactly. And, you know, what happened is that the reason that people were brainwashed around the idea that you can't call a Nazi is because after 1948, the Nazis were rehabilitated and put to work for the West as part of the Cold War apparatus. Therefore, there was a terror campaign which the parents of the baby boomer generation lived through, and as Mr. LaRouche has said on many occasions, he saw people who were genuinely heroic during the war, during the fight against Hitler, come home and capitulate to the anti-communist hysteria, and by and large became little people unwilling to fight for the truth. And so the baby boomer generation, my generation, came up with the firm belief that you don't call a Nazi. And that disease is rampant on Capitol Hill because Congress is dominated by baby boomers.
I think, Jeff, you have to include in that the rewriting of history so that the story that you've elaborated today of the nature of the networks above Hitler. I mean, Hitler was not the brightest guy in the world. You know, the question of how a movement such as the Nazi movement could come to power in a cultured country like Germany, the explanation is not his charisma, but you actually had this international force behind it. And I think that destruction of the true history is one of the reasons why they can get away with this idea that you can't call a Nazi a Nazi.
That's right. In 1932, Hitler was on the verge of committing suicide. The Nazi Party had suffered what everybody thought was a fatal defeat in the elections. And it was only as the result of massive funding to build the Nazi Party back up. And that was not just funding from big German bankers and industrialists. It came from London. It came from the Union Bank, which was owned by the American Wall Street brokerage house, Brown Brothers Harriman, with Prescott Bush specifically in charge of the portfolio of funds that went to revive the National Socialist Party in Germany for the 1933 elections.
Now, Nicole and Delonte, I'm going to come back to you in a moment, but I want to throw this next question out to Jeff. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're live every Saturday, and our guest today, our special guest, is Jeffrey Steinberg. Jeff, what has to be done to defeat Rowett and the Synarchists, given the time is running short?
Well, two things. At the webcast in Washington, D.C., on June 9th, in a dialogue with a group of local elected officials from around the country and trade union presidents, Mr. LaRouche laid down an emergency economic recovery agenda that the U.S. Congress must enact as legislation and force Bush to sign. What LaRouche said is we cannot allow the machine tool capacity and advanced industrial capacity embodied by the U.S. automobile manufacturing sector to be shut down. Therefore, the dormant capacity of the auto companies should be bought up by a temporary federal corporation created to save these jobs, save these plants, and that the federal government should emit billions of dollars in credit to give contracts to these companies, these entities, these plants, to retool and begin producing what we need for a turnaround of our collapsed national infrastructure and industrial economy. Now, that legislation will go a long way towards solving these problems. And because Rohatyn has inserted himself as the roadblock to getting those policies through, we intend to spread the truth about Rohatyn. We're going back to the World War II archives. The U.S. National Archives contain thousands and thousands of pages of documents showing U.S. military intelligence, Office of Strategic Services, State Department Intelligence and Research Bureau documents on the Synarchy, going through detailed intelligence reports, name by name identifying the Synarchists, showing their key role in Vichy France and in other pro-fascist, pro-Nazi regimes around Europe. We're going to shove that documentation in everyone's face to the point that Rowett will not dare to show up in the halls of Congress, and that we are going to eradicate the Rowett factor from within the policy-making structures of the Democratic Party.
So as Lynn said, we've got to drive the fascists out of both parties, the Cheney-Schultz networks in the Republican and the Rowett networks in the Democratic Party.
Exactly. I mean, we had this conference in October of 2004 at Rowett's Middlebury College up in Vermont, and it was a joint conference of Rowett's Institute at Middlebury and Schultz's Institute at Princeton, and the conference was on the privatization of war. These guys are openly preaching a new form of feudalism modeled on the old British East India Company. That's what they want to turn the United States into. And we're going to expose it, and we're going to take these guys down politically.
Nicole, I know that we're getting this material into the hands of legislative aides and congressmen in Washington, but I know we also are extending that now by coordinating it with visits to their offices in the districts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you'll have in the offices throughout the country, we've been organizing in the districts of the congressional leaders that we're organizing in, at the Capitol. And what we've seen is a lot of people know LaRouche's legislation. Everybody, you know, they're like, yeah, we've read it or we've gotten a copy of it. And even when you talk to some of the top directors of the offices, they agree overall with the ideas of what the legislation represents. And I guess you could say what our job is to inspire them to have enough guts to get it done, which, as you know, will require the ousting of Felix Roatan. But this is, I mean, this is the exciting part about the Congress work, is that a lot of them are just like normal people that you meet in the streets every day. And so you're really fighting with them on kind of this question of what is their identity and history. You know, are you just trying to get, a check and go home and say, I did my day's work, or are you actually trying to fight for the generations to come?
And do you find that you get under their skin when you remind them that they have some higher moral purpose as a human being?
Oh, yeah. Well, always. I mean, you get one office we had the other day. We were going after this guy on being small and thinking locally. We were saying, well, why do you have an office in D.C., and why do you vote with other congressmen if you're only supposed to think about your neighborhood? And, you know, saying you don't have the right to think like a common Joe Schmo. You were elected to think, you know, higher, to actually investigate LaRouche and his ideas. And I guess the top director was kind of laughed at by his aides in the room. So people see it. I mean, they are embarrassed, and, you know, he admitted that he didn't do the work and he had to meet with us. But you get this across the offices. They know what we're doing is right. All it is a fear to actually go forward. And so that's what we're fighting with, is this, you know, this cowardice that is set into the Democratic Party over the past year.
Well, Lynn said we've got to make the congressmen more fearful about what their constituents think than what Roatan can do.
Definitely, yeah.
Delonte, up in Boston, one of the weapons you use to inspire people to overcome fear is music. How's that campaign going up there?
Pretty good. That's pretty much our, like, a spear point to, like, changing and intervening on some of these, some of these fantasies that you have going on during the summer here. We have a big sort of institutional deployment each week at Harvard Square, which, if anyone knows anything about Boston, that's sort of the, you know, so-called intellectual hotbed of the country, right? So we deploy there with a, you know, 30-person or so chorus with the kind of effects that radiate all throughout that area. And people come from all over the world and watch this kind of music, and it just poses a true paradox in their mind. Like, what does this music have to do with, you know, defeating Earl Haddon, or, you know, the question of rebuilding, you know, the kind of Eurasian land bridge LaRouche is calling for? So it gives us the opportunity to open up the doorways for the kind of organizing that's going on. And this is the same thing. We've taken this kind of principle toward a lot of the organizing with the congressmen personally, like we did with the Boston Convention in 2004. It's really just opened up the doorway for our youth movement to have a footstep into the Democratic Party. So it's been a very effective move that LaRouche has sort of put forward as a challenge, particularly for the Boston local, to really master this idea of classical artistic composition. And we're going to be taking this down, as I said before, to Washington, D.C., and utilizing this sort of, you know, artistic principle, bringing in beauty to the Democratic Party.
Well, in contrast to Roatan, you certainly do need some beauty in that party.
Surely.
Jeff, let me get back to you on the upcoming events in St. Petersburg, the G8 Summit. I understand there's a typically lunatic proposal for the United States to go in there and push down the dollar as though it would be some solution. What did Mr. LaRouche have to say about the upcoming plans for the G8 summit?
Well, given the hyper-fragile state of the world monetary system, what Mr. LaRouche said is that you can't start playing around and experimenting with some alternative to the U.S. dollar. The only thing that you can do that will bring some stability to this system is to actually strengthen the dollar, and the only way to do that is through efforts that reinforce once again the role of sovereign governments to define monetary and credit policy.
So we come back to the same issue again, the idea of the nation state with FDR-type credit policy versus private control of credit and fascism.
That's right. Roosevelt in 1944 was in the position to convene the conference at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, and dictate the terms of a new international financial system. And, you know, what he did was the opposite of what the British and French and poor, pathetic Woodrow Wilson had done at Versailles. At Versailles, Germany was hit with massive war reparations. There was no debt moratorium. There was no forgiveness of the World War I debt. And the preconditions were set for another world war. And that's exactly what we got less than two generations later. What Roosevelt understood was you had to reestablish solid relations, fixed relations among the world's currencies, that you had to write off most of the Depression era and wartime debt, which did occur over the course of the remainder of the 1940s, even into the 50s. It was ultimately all written off. And that you had to then create a stable monetary system and a series of policies for rebuilding a war-ravaged world. The German economic miracle of the 1940s and 50s, the Japanese economic miracle, the emergence of South Korea as a modern industrial nation state. All of these were exemplary of the kinds of things that still occurred even despite the death of Roosevelt. Had Roosevelt lived, there's no doubt in my mind that we never would have had a Cold War, that the division of Europe would have been avoided, and that the colonial powers would have never been able to reestablish their colonies after the war.
So we're at this point now where the world is on a dollar basis, and the destruction of the dollar, any effort to tinker with the dollar, would have devastating consequences to the whole financial system.
It'll bring everything down.
Well, let me just ask you, on related to that, is the comment from Mr. LaRouche that he once again smells the hands of British geopolitics behind the events in the last week in North Korea with the so-called North Korean missile crisis, and also the Israeli assault on the Palestinian state in Gaza, or the Palestinian entity in Gaza. What can you tell us about that?
Well, start from the fact that back in April, May, when you had a revolt of retired American 3- and 4-star generals and admirals, and a number of other events, including an escalating focus on Vice President Cheney in the Fitzgerald investigation into the Valerie Plame Wilson leak. At that point, Vice President Cheney suffered at least a temporary defeat. He was promoting a hard confrontation, a military confrontation with Iran, probably as early as June, July of this year. That was prevented. So now we're on somewhat of a diplomatic track with Iran talking with the Europeans and with the promise that the U.S., the Europeans, and Russia will sit down at a table with the Iranians if they accept the terms of the original proposal. So the Iran situation is at least tilted for the moment away from confrontation. So therefore, the synarchists, the people who pull the strings on Dick Cheney, the people like Rowetten and Schultz, who want a world devoid of nation states, they say, okay, we have a list of targets. We have a list of hotspot crises that we can provoke. We don't simply have to rely on one option being Iran. And so they have people who are agents, people like Benjamin Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. They have other people like the head of state of North Korea, who's known by profile and who therefore is susceptible to manipulation. You've got President Ahmadinejad in Iran, who they thought they could manipulate into a confrontation to give Cheney and company a pretext. And then, of course, Netanyahu was here in the United States about 2.5 weeks ago for a conference of the American Enterprise Institute, the leading neoconservative fascist think tank in Washington. And they had a meeting out in Vail, Colorado. Netanyahu was there and had extensive private discussions with Vice President Cheney. What exactly they discussed, we don't know. But there's no doubt in my mind that there's a correlation between those discussions and those plans and the fact that we've got the Israeli government invading the Gaza Strip, stationing troops on the border with Syria, threatening a war against Syria, and a situation that had been relatively calm. Not progressing towards a solution, but relatively calm, suddenly is a major point of flare-up. So, you know, LaRouche is saying, look, I know how great conflagrations start. World War I was largely the result of the King of England, Edward VII, manipulating and cajoling a bunch of other European monarchs, half of whom were his cousins, manipulating them. Go back and read Othello by William Shakespeare and study the character of Iago. And you get an idea of what LaRouche means when he says, I smell a British-Venetian intrigue here. That suddenly these situations are just popping up on the verge of exploding. Don't forget, a week from today, Bush will be in St. Petersburg for his first of two private summit meetings with Putin in the midst of the G8 summit meeting. Very important event because there's a whole coming together of governments of Eurasia who want development, not war, and who are prepared to actually put together a new set of policy arrangements. They can't do it on their own. The U.S. has to be brought in. So this G8 summit meeting may prove to be a more important and historic event than even the Russian sponsors anticipate at this point.
So this brings us back to the theme of the show, the question of time is running out. A significant part of this is that with these hot spots potentially set to blow with a British hand in there, with Cheney looking for this, you also have the simmering volatility of the financial system. We're really heading toward a period, as LaRouche said, in September, where between now and then decisions have to be made, and one of the most important is to defeat the influence of Rohatyn and the Democratic Party.
That's exactly right. Clean out the synarchist, fascist cesspool in the Democratic Party, and you break the resistance to going back to the traditional constituents of FDR, what he called the forgotten men and women of America. You've got the lower 80% income brackets out there seething over what's happened to them over the last several decades, and especially since Bush and Cheney came into office. They want something better. They want something different. And they're not going to simply give their votes to the Democrats simply because their names aren't George Bush or Dick Cheney. The demand is going to be that the Democratic Party goes back to the Roosevelt principles, which means aligning with LaRouche. And we've reached the moment where the Democratic Party is no longer big enough to have both the LaRouche movement and Felix Rohatyn. And I'll tell you right now, we have no intention of going anywhere.
Well, and that's why our listeners should be calling in to get the pamphlets and the white papers to get them out, but also to make contributions so that we can have, as Delonte was talking in Nicole, an increased number of LaRouche youth movement activists educating the youth of this country so we learn the lessons of history and actually get the country back on its historic constitutional course. So we have a webcast with Lyndon LaRouche coming up on July 20th. That's Thursday, July 20th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Nicole and Delonte, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Harlan.
Yeah, thank you.
You'll be looking forward to seeing people in Washington. And Jeff, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a lot of fun, Harley. Thanks.
Okay, this is the LaRouche Show, and we're out.
Thank you.